You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sand.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, and today we're beginning the first of a series of shows on prisons and prisoners in the United States. But first, I'd like to acknowledge World Refugee Day, held on June 20th, and review how this day came about. For years, many countries and regions have been holding their own refugee days and even weeks. One of the most widespread is Africa Refugee Day, which is celebrated on June 20th in several countries. The refugee challenge, though, in the 21st century is changing rapidly. People are forced to flee their homes for increasingly complicated and interlinked reasons. Some 40 million people worldwide are already uprooted by violence and persecution, and it is likely that the future will see more people on the run as a growing number of push factors compound one another to create conditions for further forced displacement. A breakdown on statistics in regions with the most acute crises. The top 10 refugee populations. Afghanistan has 2,108,000 refugees. Iraq, 1,451,000. Sudan, 686,000. Somalia, 464,000. The Democratic Republic of Congo, 402,000. Burundi, 397,000. Vietnam, 374,000. Turkey, 227,000. Angola, 207,000. Myanmar, 203,000. Countries with the highest number of internally displaced people: Sudan, 5,800,000. Colombia, 4 million. Iraq, 2.5 million. Democratic Republic of Congo, 1,400,000. Uganda, 1,300,000. Now, this doesn't even mention Palestine, which has, of course, refugee camps in Jordan, Lebanon, Syria. Palestinians are in terrible crisis right now with an exodus from Iraq. So these are just the latest numbers. They do not, as you hear, include the Palestinians. So as an expression of solidarity with Africa, which traditionally has shown refugees great generosity, the UN General Assembly adopted Resolution 55/76 on the 4th of December 2000. In this resolution, the General Assembly noted that 2001 marked the 50th anniversary of the 1951 convention related to the status of refugees, and that the Organization of African Unity, the OAU, incidentally, this OAU was replaced by the African Union in 2002. So the OAU had agreed to have International Refugee Day coincide with Africa Refugee Day on June 20th. The Assembly decided that from 2001, the 20th of June would be celebrated as World Refugee Day. You can learn more about the 1951 Convention relating to the status of refugees, the key legal document in defining who is a refugee and what their rights are and the legal obligation of states. You can learn more about them at the UN Refugee Agency website, www.unhcr.org. Now we'll turn to a different aspect of life in the United States, that of prisoners and jails and the people who serve time in these facilities, as well as what happens to their families and the communities in which these facilities are built. Over time, Raising Sand will review many aspects of the penal system in the U.S., and you're invited to participate if you've been in the system, have friends or family who have been in the system, or you work in the system. Send me email at susan@raisingsandradio.org. Today we'll talk with Nick Zabula of the Thousand Kites Project and then Bruno Ruhlein of the Prison Literature Project. But first, you may be wondering, what is the difference between a prison and a jail? The terms jail and prisons are sometimes used interchangeably, although most members of law enforcement distinguish between the two. Primarily, the difference is that a jail is used by local jurisdictions, such as counties and cities, to confine people for short periods of time. A prison or penitentiary is administered by the state and is used to house convicted people for periods of a much longer duration. Both are part of a larger penal system which includes other aspects of criminal justice such as courts, law enforcement, crime labs, and so on. Because a jail is designed for short periods of time only, it tends to have fewer amenities than a prison. Individuals who are being housed in a jail have access to bathrooms and are provided with food and water, and sometimes are able to socialize in common areas. Most jails are designed to hold a small number of people and have relatively lax security when compared to prisons. A jail houses people who have been convicted to serve a short sentence, individuals awaiting trial, people who have not yet paid bail, and people who have just been picked up on suspicion of committing a crime. They're then processed through a booking procedure, and the criminal justice system decides what to do with them after that. In a prison, the amenities are much more extensive, as some prisoners may be serving their lives behind bars. Prisoners have exercise areas, common areas for eating, and sometimes socializing in lower security areas. Some also have church facilities and an educational facility, which includes classrooms and libraries. In lower security prisons, such as those used to imprison people convicted of white-collar crimes, the prisons could sometimes be mistaken for a hotel. In most cases, prison inmates are expected to share cells with other inmates, and because of the long duration of most prison sentences, a complex social and political structure arises among the prisoners. And as I say, Raising Sand will go further into this and review some of these social and political structures that arise. A prison is capable of handling far more prisoners than a jail is, and the prisoners are typically segregated on the basis of the types of crimes that they have been convicted of as a safety precaution. In addition, in countries which still have capital punishment, as in the United States, a prison maintains facilities to carry out capital sentences, along with housing for people sentenced to this type of punishment. In general, the prison facility as a whole is very tightly secured, even if not all the people inside are violent, to prevent escapes or potential violence between wings of the prison. Prison staff are specially trained to work in a prison environment, and a board of governors appointed by the state oversees prison management. Again, we will go more into this because prisoners are becoming more and more private enterprises and have been privatized to a large extent, and we will review that over time. Meanwhile, I'd like to welcome Nick Zabula.
It's good to have you with us, Nick.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you because today you're going to talk to us about the Thousand Kites Project. And this is part of our ongoing examination and research into the U.S. prison system. And I'm going to ask you, Nick, to tell us a little bit about yourself and then the Thousand Kites Project.
Okay. I live here in Whitesburg, Kentucky, which is in the farthest southeast corner of Kentucky, right on the Virginia-West Virginia border. It's coal mining country and also the heart of bluegrass and mountain music here. Lots of mountains and whatnot. And I work as an artist at an arts organization called Apple Shop, which has been here since 1969, making films, video, and running a little community radio station. And back in 1998, I was a volunteer DJ on our community radio station, Mountain Community Radio. We like to call it the voice of the Hillbilly Nation. When we had a prison boom in which we had prisons built all over our region as a form of economic development, as a way of providing jobs for our community so that people could work at those prisons.
The prisoners were coming from other states into this region?
Oh, that's right. They came from all over the U.S., as far away as Hawaii and even the Virgin Islands, to fill the beds so that we could have full prisons here and get the prisons open so people could get jobs to replace the shrinking coal economy.
And I don't want to get you off track from your intro, but I would like to talk a little bit about whether these are private or public prisons at some point.
Okay, definitely. So I was volunteering as a DJ on Mountain Community Radio, and we were doing the only hip-hop show in a sea of bluegrass. And I think for that reason, the prisoners chose to reach out to us with letters, specifically from two supermax prisons, Red Onion and Walnuts Ridge State Prison. And what they described in their letters was human rights violations, electronic tasering, being strapped down on tables for sometimes as long as 72 hours, racial discrimination. And so we, as artists, felt that we should look into this story that was happening right in our local community, just 20 minutes away from our art center.
Wow, so this was totally out of the blue for you.
It was out of the blue. We knew that the prisons were being built, of course. We saw that. But I think the human rights violations, it came normally when people want us to work with them as artists, because we are community artists, they walk in the door. And in this case, it came in the form of hundreds of letters, often letters that were describing instances of the same incident, you know, where someone saw someone be beaten. And so we decided that we needed to do something about it. Of course, what we found was a pretty complex story. Some of the earlier things we did back in 98-99 were to, as a way of kind of, since we're a poor white community, poor rural white area, and most of the folks that were being shipped in were people of color from urban areas, we decided to bring a traditional mountain musician, banjo player, together with a hip-hop musician. And we did this to challenge the local corrections officials, who kept kind of talking about how these were the worst of the worst. They were doing everything they could to dehumanize the prisoners that were in those prisons to the local community, in a way as to say, hey, don't worry about what's going on up there. These people deserve it. And so we did began a series of radio and kind of artistic events to explore that and to actually just try to figure out who was in there. So we did the hip-hop and the traditional musician, and then they made something called Hill Hop, which people in our community and people in the prison community liked an awful lot.
And so how did you begin to make those connections? I want to first tell our listeners that you have a website called thousandkites.org, and there's some radio broadcasts from there that they can go and listen to. How did you head in that direction?
Sure. I think, well, one of the first things we wanted to do was we decided to organize just a day on our radio station in which we would get the prisoner families to call in and just send a greeting to their loved one. And we decided to do it during the holiday season in some ways to make it, you know, more palatable for our listening audience and a little more challenging for people who might be angry about it. You know, it's the holiday time, Christmas, Kwanzaa, that time, around that time in December. And so we asked the prisoners to send us their loved ones' mailing addresses.
How did you get in touch with the prisoners?
They can hear our radio show.
Okay.
So we broadcast to 11 prisons. Uh-huh. And what we figured out is no matter how, you know, isolated, some of these folks are in their cells for 23 hours a day, the correction officers are very dedicated to making sure that the prisoners at least have a radio. It makes their job easier. And so many of the prisoners listen on the radio. If they don't have a radio, we actually have prisoners who will mimic the show to their cellmates, people down the row a little bit, so they can actually hear what is on our radio program. Mm.
Talk a little bit about Thousand Kites and what it means.
Sure. A kite is it's a prison slang for to send a letter or a message. And what we decided, while we had watched this story unfold in our community, we produced a bunch of media tools around it, including a documentary film, a play, a radio series, and some interactive tools for people to explore the criminal justice system in their own community. And the idea is that we just feel that in our area, in the U.S., that people don't really talk about who's in prison, how do prisons affect our communities, how does the criminal justice system affect our communities. And we found time and time again that discussion, when people had it, they found it to be very interesting and positive for their community. And so Kites comes out of that desire to have to use art to spark dialogue and essentially to send a message to ourselves.
And so let's now talk a little bit about what these prisons are. I want to first just bracket that by saying I actually met someone a few years ago, actually around about the time that you're talking about, the late 1990s, who had made a huge amount of money as a contractor building prisons. And he was obviously a private individual, and he was telling me that this is pretty much a new industry that's coming up, privatizing prisons. Is that true in your area?
Sure, the privatization of prisons, and I mean, even if a prison is still a state-run facility, it is amazing the number of ways it slowly becomes privatized with different contracts within it. The medical service might be privatized. But for example, here in our listening area, we have a women's prison, which is run by the Correction Corporation of America. And what they do is they run prisons around the country, and they lease those beds out. So in this case, there are women from Hawaii. Now, we're in Kentucky. Hawaii is a far, far away from here. And they are leasing those beds out to the state of Hawaii for these women to be essentially celled here. Private prisons are, you know, they're run by corporations, and it's a way for states to outsource running the prison system. As far as I can tell, in our experience, there's some highly, I mean, ethically and moral issues along with that, but just from if you actually believe in the idea of corrections not being for profit and not just being profit centers, but they're actually about rehabilitation, it's highly problematic.
What are you hearing from the prisoners?
It's, of course, a mix because we have 11 prisons here just a short drive from us. We have some prisoners who, you know, tell us essentially that they're locked in their cells. This is at a supermax for 23 hours, and the only interaction they have with people is through educational would be through TV broadcasts, and that's pretty limited. Other folks, I mean, are going to drug counseling and whatnot. I also have to say that, you know, we also look at, well, it's a side note maybe to this discussion, but we actually are also concerned with the correction officers and the effect that prison siting has on our local community's health. We're also concerned with the folks who are working in those prisons.
Talk about that.
I mean, what we found is that you have these prisons being built in rural communities that are struggling across the U.S. 70% of prisons are built in rural areas here. And basically, these are areas that are desperate for any kind of economy. And so we call it the economics of last resort. They either go for a prison, a waste disposal plant, or a casino. These are the three options that you might find in the Mississippi Delta, rural California, upstate New York, or here in central Appalachia, where politicians are eager to try to show they're doing something for the community. They can't get in industries to sprout. They don't want to actually do local economic development. So they're like, hey, we've secured a prison for you. But what we found is the actual economic impact, and we've looked at this with economists, is very minimal. You don't really see a huge uptick in your local economy from having a prison built here. In fact, you often see a strain on your water system, your roads from having the prison here. Prisons are actually, you know, use a lot of water. And if you're a small little town of 1,200 like we are, that's a lot of, you know, it really puts a strain on your water. But the other thing is that the folks who work at the prisons, suddenly they have mental health issues. And so your local drug rehab person can tell you, and I've called around all over the country. You look at a new community that has a prison built, and they're going to be finding folks who are self-medicating, correction officers and correction staff who are self-medicating to deal with working in an extremely depressing environment.
This is going to be a bit of a stretch, perhaps, but we see some of the same thing in the U.S. military, and the psychological damage of those kids, especially the ones that have worked in prisons over in Iraq, is tremendous. So it's really not that big a gap between what's going on outside of the country and what seems to be going on inside the prison systems.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And I mean, again, like if you look at our population, folks, young people coming out of high school, they can go work in the coal mines, they can work in the gas industry, they can go off into the military, or the other job available to them would be to work in the prison.
What kind of money do they get there?
Well, I would say the money is okay. It ranges, you know, starting off at $26,000-$27,000 a year, which is, you know, it's a doable wage, probably not nearly as much as it should be. But the motivating factor for someone to take a job at the prison would be health insurance.
Uh-huh.
If you go talk to folks who work in the prison, it's often that there's a state health insurance plan, you know, government health insurance connected to that. But, for example, in our documentary film, Up the Ridge, we interviewed a correction officer who had quit, and he said he liked the money, and the day he quit, he started cutting grass with a push lawnmower, but he found it was much healthier for him to give up the prison job.
And then, so the lawnmower job obviously didn't carry health insurance with it, but it was worth it to him.
That's right. And I think what we see is, you know, there's a lot of restrictions on who can work in a prison. So if you have a rural elder population, the age restriction, you have an area that you have a lot of disabled people, they can't work at the prison. So you see a high turnover, and eventually you'll have people commuting in an hour, hour and a half away from your community who work at the prison, but when they leave, they're not spending those dollars in the local community.
Interesting.
They're heading out to the tri-state area. So, that's the other thing I can say. Another way we've connected, I'm kind of hopping topics on you, but with the way with the prison families, that's like they have a hard time getting out to these rural prisons. There's no bus station. There's no plane. There's no train. It's very difficult. So you find that using radio has been a way for them to connect with their family members in a real way. Collect calls to prisons are extremely costly. I mean, you're talking $30, $40 for a phone call.
I'm going to run some of the messages that families have sent to their loved ones in prisons.
Excellent.
And, some of those are really quite heartbreaking, especially since they were at the Christmas season. There's a sense, I think, that people that are in prison deserve to be there and have done something so heinous that they're, you know, no matter what happens to them, the larger population shouldn't really be bothered with that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, one thing to think about is that often we like to think of prisoners as being violent people. And what we have found, and it's proven if you look at the criminal justice statistics, that the vast majority of people that are in prison are in there for nonviolent offenses. And many, many people are in there for something to do with some sort of drug offense, like possession of marijuana, for example. And when we look at that and you start to think these are people who are eventually going to come back out into our community, and we have to think, how do we want them to come out? So if we look at Wallens Ridge or Red Onion State Prison, at various points in those prisons' history, people have been, you know, restrained on tables, electronically tasered, held in isolation for long periods of time. And really, mentally, their mental health has been challenged because we have a particularly harsh prison system. Now, these folks will eventually come out into our communities. Are they going to do better when they come out into the community? Is this the type of person? Do you want someone who's gone through a very harsh system to come back and be released? And so I think that's one thing that we have to face. The other, just straight, is economics. The prison system is extremely expensive. It costs $25,000 to house someone in a facility. That's just one person. Is this the best use of our taxpayer money to put people in cells? And we have to kind of think, you know, we have something at stake here also. Are there people that should be in prison? Absolutely. But do we want to have a system that's so harsh that people have very little hope? In the state of Virginia, there's no parole. So if you get 20 years, you are going to serve the whole 20 years. Where would be the motivation for rehabilitation? So we end up all paying either through our tax dollars or, you know, the health of our communities for a U.S. criminal justice system that has burgeoned just absolutely out of control. It was, I think when we started this project, it was 1.5 million people were in prison, and now it's 2.2 million. And the number of people who cycle through the U.S. prison system in any given year who are connected is equal to the total population of the 11 least populated states of the United States.
I've heard it's like one in every 32 people at some point will go through the system, the prison system in the United States.
That's right.
It's astonishing. One in 32 people. You mentioned that some of these women prisoners are from Hawaii. They get sent over here. When they're released, are they then taken, do they get a fare back to Hawaii, or what happens? I mean, we see movies where, you know, the prison doors open, the prisoner leaves, and the doors close, and that's it. What happens to these people that are in the middle of, as far as they're concerned, nowhere, near family that can support them when they get out? How do they get back? What do they do? Do you have an insight into that?
Sure. One interesting thing that we learned through our investigation of making a documentary about how are these prisoners getting here is that there are actually people who make a living as brokers, who broker prison beds to state systems, where they're actually selling the bed and placing the prisoner. So it's kind of like a commodities market. And what we found is that, you know, prisoners are sent back to their state where they've been far away, and they are released back in their local state. But one thing that we have to think about in that dynamic is the connection with the family. And when we look at recidivism studies, folks who are successful when they are released were people who had strong connections with their family through their incarceration and after their incarceration. And so if you put someone 500, 1,000 miles away, 2,000 miles away from their loved one, especially when we're talking about low-income people, that's who's in our prison system, you're going to see that you're making the challenge even more difficult for us to be successful having rehabilitation for those who get caught in our system.
So, Nick, you mentioned the film that you've done, and also want to point our readers, listeners back to thousandkites.org, where there's an overview of Wallen's Ridge prison facility. It looks like a fortress. So you did that clip, but you're talking also a movie that you've done?
Sure. Working with my co-producer, Amelia Kirby, we created a feature-length documentary film called Up the Ridge, that really documents our story here since 1998 to present day, looking at the human rights violations and the prisoners being shipped in and the impacts on the correction community. And Amelia was an excellent co-producer because she grew up right in the town underneath where that prison is built. And many of her high school classmates actually ended up going on to work at that prison.
And how can listeners get hold of that?
You could either Google Up the Ridge, and that will come up to you, or you can go to the Thousand Kites website, and you can follow the links from the front page to Up the Ridge and see a trailer that gives you some background on this rural prison sighting phenomenon.
Thanks for being with us today.
Hey, thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking with you all.
Nick Zabula mentioned inviting prisoner families to call in their Christmas greetings to the incarcerated loved ones. Let's listen to a few of those greetings.
Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, we'd like to say Merry Christmas to Rob Park. Jason, tell your dad a Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. I miss you. Call me.
We love you, Rob. Call us.
Where's Rob at?
He's in Kentucky at Otter Creek. He's been there for quite a while.
Well, now, I mean, is there any hope that he'll be home shortly for the holidays or anything like that?
Well, it won't be this year.
Maybe next year.
Yeah, maybe next year. Thank you.
You're more than welcome.
We love you, Rob.
We have a next caller. Okay, go ahead. Who are you calling for?
John L. Johnson. Okay. He's in Marion, Virginia.
Okay, and where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Elkhorn. I'm his sister, Eileen, and I'd love to wish him a very Merry Christmas and tell him to hang in there. God is with him, and we're all praying for him.
My name is Gail, and I'm calling to wish my husband a very Merry Christmas. His name is Joshua Cook, and he's at Pocahontas in Virginia. And I just want to tell him I love him.
Where are you calling from?
I am in Kentucky Chicken Man. I want to wish my husband, Alfonso Dixon.
Yes. Oh, now this right here is a tale in itself, Amelia. Now, Alfonso, I sort of hooked these two up on my show.
You sure did.
So now, how's Alfonso doing?
He's doing great.
And he's over at Wallen's Ridge.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And how are you doing?
I'm doing good.
That's wonderful, girl. Everything going all right for you, too?
Everything's going good, yes. It's been almost 3 years now.
Yes, it has.
Yep.
Doesn't seem that long, though, does it?
No, it doesn't. I want to wish him a Merry Christmas, and even though he can't be here with us in body, he's here with us in spirit, and I love you very much, baby, and Dad recorded you a message, so I'm going to play that message too, okay?
Well, go right ahead, dear. That's what this is all about.
I love you, baby. I'll see you soon.
Hello, Fonzie, son. I love you very much. This is your dad. I wanted to wish you a Merry, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. I miss you an awful lot, son, an awful lot. And I wish you were here with me right now. I need your strength because mine is not as strong as everybody thinks. But I miss you and love you very, very much. And I do want to wish you a Merry, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Okay, I just wanted to leave a message for Robbie Little. And I wanted to wish him a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year and to love Jesse, Bev, Jimmy, Courtney, and his new cousin, Hunter. I'm calling from West Virginia in Brushport.
Hello, this is Calls from Home. Do you have a holiday greeting you'd like to send out?
Oh, my. We love him. We support him. And he's to believe that he still has a future and a life when he comes out of prison. Don't let the time do the time and use the time constructively. His name is Christian Jones. He's in United States Penitentiary in Terre Haute, Indiana. And he has a long time.
Hello, caller. You're live on the air.
Yeah.
You have a message you'd like to send out?
Yeah, to Darla Snar. Merry Christmas, and we all love you.
Love you.
Love you, Linda.
Dave, Darlene, Tiffany, Trinity, and Candy, and Fern, we love you.
And where are y'all calling from tonight?
Preston, Iowa.
All right, great. Well, we're glad to hear from you, and I'm sure he is, too.
Thanks.
Take care. Hello, and welcome to Calls from Home. Do you have a holiday greeting you'd like to send out?
Hi, this is for my husband, Zachary Vanderhorst, and Sam Quentin. Happy anniversary, baby. I love you.
You can learn more about the Thousand Kite Project at www.thousandkites.org or learn more about the Apple Shop at www.appleshop.org, appalshop.org. Now let's turn to Bruno Ruland, who was a founding member of the Prison Literature Project. We'll hear from Bruno about the Prison Literature Project and also hear some of the letters written by prisoners to the project. I asked Bruno Ruland to describe the Prison Literature Project.
It actually started probably 20 years ago at Bound Together Books, which is a small anarchist bookstore collectively run in San Francisco. And someone at Bound Together had a friend in prison. They discovered that you can't send books to a prisoner as a private individual. You have to send them through a bookstore or a publisher. And so they, as part of Bound Together Books, they sent books to their friend and their friends in prison heard about it, and they sent letters, and it just grew from there, and it just constantly has grown. For like 20 years, we get like more letters every month than the month before, basically, and now we're getting 1,200 letters a month, probably. Wow. And
we'll read some of those letters during this show, so that's pretty amazing that you get 1,200 letters a month.
It's overwhelming, especially for our kind of grew out of this anarchist milieu of no budget, nobody in charge, no hierarchy of authorities, and really no like foundation grants or anything, although we've gotten a couple of really small ones, but not for years now. You know, it's very super grassroots.
Can ordinary folks make donations if they want to?
Of course.
That'd be great. We'll talk about that towards the end of the show. That might help.
Sure.
As I mentioned, this is part of our ongoing series on prisons, and I'm finding that this kind of thing, these small groups, are actually all over the country. It's really amazing.
There are, in fact, about, I don't know, there are like probably 15 other groups that send books to prisoners, too. And three or four probably are as active as we are. And they all seem kind of similar, though. They all seem to come out of some kind of anarchist milieu, and they're all very homemade, super grassroots.
And so what have you learned about you personally as an individual about the prison system from this?
Prison system, like, if you pay attention, which you're encouraged not to, you know, it's huge and it's a disaster and it's like a bad idea that has grown to enormous and super expensive proportions.
And it's very well funded.
Yes, and it's sort of like the military now. It's like there's a lot of people who are doing very well out of the whole system. Like, you know, the Guards Union has incredible clout, and so they get lots of money, and they people who build prisons, and, you know, it's in fact, it's partly being privatized, so there's like the Corrections Corporation of America and some other people who, you know, lots of buddies in Washington, D.C.
Is the Corrections Corporation of America a corporation, a private corporation? It's not part of the federal government?
Right, yeah. Well, it has been the coming thing in prisons for a while. So it's kind of the whole prison system has its own momentum, but it's not a good thing for anybody. It's, you know, the recidivism rates are, like, terrible.
It seems as though when prisoners are abused, the general population outside of the prisons doesn't really hear about it, or if they do, they don't really care that much. I mean, I've heard things about Pelican Bay. Prisoners in Pelican Bay are treated in a way that most of us would consider completely inhumane, and yet it goes on, and no one seems to give it any attention.
In the last decade or two, the prisons have come up with this idea of the SHUs, which is a secure housing unit. They basically put prisoners in tiny rooms with a fluorescent light, and they, you know, they're there for 23 hours a day in isolation. Basically, it's a way to torture people without, like, doing some kind of Gestapo thing where you, or medieval torture thing where you leave stars and tear people to pieces. It's really a great way to torture people without, you know, seeming like you're doing it. Yeah, there's SHUs all over the country now.
And you probably, as a warden in there, become fairly accustomed to that kind of behavior, so you don't even blink an eye when you see this kind of stuff after a while, I would imagine.
Part of it is prisons are so isolated and so kind of removed from the surrounding areas. They're just these giant walled-off places, and they're just kind of walled off from the communities of the rest of the country. You know, they live in their own kind of isolation.
And there's no recourse for anyone that's inside the prison who's running into trouble. Now, I would imagine, and from what I hear, there's the kinds of trouble you can run into with both with fellow prisoners and then with the authority system over you, the wardens and so forth, and you have no recourse.
Yeah, it doesn't really seem like it. In fact, the courts make it harder and harder for prisoners to file lawsuits and, you know, find some way outside of the prison's own system to protest about conditions.
For you, why do you keep doing it?
A few reasons. Like, one of them is the appeal of giving people something for nothing is actually quite satisfying, you know, in capitalist America, to do something that's actually just plain old free.
It's almost a dirty word these days, isn't it?
Yeah, it's as much as I'm appalled by the prison system, it's kind of the pleasure of doing something for free is a significant factor for me personally anyway.
So let's talk about how the system works, the literature project.
You know, we get letters. We have a small office, crammed full of books, a way too small office. It's all volunteers. We have like 3 meetings a week nowadays. And people show up, you know, there's somebody with a key who's guaranteed to be here, who knows the ropes and can explain to new people how things work here. And there's a huge pile of letters always. We just grab a letter from the top of the pile and, you know, read it and try and find what the prisoner is looking for to read. Package up the books and then put postage on them and take them to the post office every week.
So let me describe this office. It is a small office. It's probably about 12 by 12 or 14 by 4, lined with books. And since you are going through these letters and looking to see what people want, I would imagine you know where most of these books are. They're fairly well labeled.
Fairly,
how much work is it? So you get one letter that says, I want 3 different books of wide genre, and you pick them out?
Yeah, basically. You know, prisoners, they know from, you know, talking to other prisoners who've sent letters to us that they can't ask for specific titles, really. That's just too hard. But they ask for subjects and, you know, areas. And they know that they have to be a bit broad in what they ask for. And they know that they should give us more than one choice, too, usually. So it's usually possible to find 2 or 3 books that'll satisfy what they're looking for. And, you know, they're looking for all kinds of books, too, which is good.
What kinds of books do you not send them? Is there anything like that?
We don't send serial killer true crime kind of books, really. We don't send romance novels and we don't send horror novels, but we don't want to be like, here, you have to take these books that we know are good for you and are going to make you a better educated person. We want to like kind of believe that reading itself is a good thing. And in fact, I mean, that's one reason I do this too, is because books are like, they're the key to making sense of life. Books make the world much, much bigger and richer place. So, you know, we're not too insistent about what people want to read. We'll send like mysteries and science fiction and pulpy things too, because reading in general is mm-hmm. good. It's better than like watching TV or...
And your brain also needs rest if you're reading heavy-duty stuff. I know I myself, every now and again, just start reading something that's straightforward, mystery or...
Yeah.
So...
But there's, from our letters, prisoners really have a big, I want to improve myself, I want to, like, you know, learn from my mistakes, I want to, like, think about my life. They really do have a like, there's kind of a sense of, like, yes, I've blown it, here I am in prison, but this is a chance, since I have a huge amount of spare time, for me to, like, actually think, and, well, reading books is a great way to think.
I'm going to make a wild jump here, and I want you to correct me if it's a completely wrong assumption, but I would imagine that some of the folks in jail aren't readers in general, that maybe uh-huh. literature is not their strong suit. So is there a way of people to improve their reading skills through the books or through the prison system itself?
There are, you know, literacy programs for prisoners. There are some, but not very many, and of course they're always getting cut back because of the perpetual budget crisis and things. But, you know, I guess that's part of the idea, too. We get lots of barely literate letters, too, and, you know, it's then you just try and find a book that's, like, more, you know, basic and simple. Like, we actually have some kind of kids' books if they really seem barely literate, and we have some, you know, the kind of things that you read in high school when you're learning to read, like John Steinbeck and the kind of more simple, full, I don't know, Mark Twain. Yeah, we try and, you know, fit their level of literacy.
And do you get a sense from the letters that you receive thanking you for the books that they're talking about these ideas with one another in the prison?
Yeah, you know, we get lots of letters effusively thanking us. And in fact, you know, there's a long history of books, like the classical one is the autobiography of Malcolm X. You know, they're books about how I ended up in prison, and I learned through books how to become a human being. I learned about how being in prison and reading books turned my life around completely. Malcolm X's autobiography is the classic one, but there's like, actually now there's dozens of them.
Hmm.
So it's, yes, there's lots of evidence that it's really important.
Bruno, let's talk for a moment about a society that has a system like our prison system in the U.S. I think the number is 1 out of 32 people in the United States will pass through the system at some level. How do we, the richest country in the world, end up with a prison system like this and with people in it that have been completely left behind, barely learned to read, and say that this is the best thing that could have happened to them, that getting hold of this book has been a highlight of their lives? To me, it's kind of a travesty in a country like this.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it's kind of the American way. Like, America is so money-oriented and, you know, so oriented towards capitalism. It has such hegemony here that one thing it does is produce lots of casualties. There's something not very caring about the larger society. It's, you know, this American individualist thing of you gotta stand on your own feet, and if you fail, then you're a failure, and, you know, we're not going to help you. And it's generations of that has created a lot of casualties. I think, like, other countries don't have the beaten down underclass that America produces. You know, since Americans are so interested in success and it's always like a personal accomplishment, oh, that's a mythology. In reality, it doesn't work that way. That fill prisons with people and then think of them as failures, the losers, and, you know, we don't want to have anything to do with them, almost like they're, you know, radioactive or something.
They're also becoming a commodity, aren't they? I mean, if you're making money off even the prison system now, the poor, the undertrodden, and the casualties of the world or their country are also part of the system.
Yes.
You make money on them.
Yeah, that kind of like redoubles the tragedy of it all, and, like, you know, makes it all horribly ironic. And here we are in the land of the free, like, locking people up into this commodity thing. Like, that it's like becoming a business, and it's kind of got its own momentum. So we're even less interested in like trying to figure out how to keep people out of prisons. There's so many people, you know, doing very well out of the prison system, people who build prisons and the guards.
Before we talk about the unions of guards, it's kind of an interesting topic, I think, an interesting area to explore a little bit. I want to remind our listeners that we're talking with Bruno Ruland, who is a member of the Prison Literature Project and has been for about 20 years. Listeners can go to www.prisonersliteratureproject.com to learn more, or even better, if you want to donate or learn more about the project, email prisonlit@yahoo.com. That's prisonlit@yahoo.com. And the email address is prisonersliteratureproject.com.
So that's the website.
That is the website, yeah. Bruno, let's talk about this in an era where we have an economic system that's been spread around the world, usually with globalization and so forth. Unions are not considered the thing to do. Belonging to a union is not the same level of valor that it was, say, in the 50s and 60s or the 30s. So here we are now, we have a union for guards. Is that what you're saying? Do you know much about that?
Not too much. I know that it's really powerful union. They have like well-paid lobbyists in Sacramento, and at least in California, and they just love to fill prisons and expand prisons, which prisons are so full now they need expanding unless we change the laws and find ways to not lock so many people up. Yeah, the guards have a huge amount of clout in state capital, and so, like, you know, even though it's becoming generally known that the prison system is fantastically expensive and not functional, that there's still very little that's actually done about it. Politicians don't really seem to be able to deal with it.
I'm going to jump out here and say it's hardly surprising that they don't want to deal with prisons when they don't want to deal with the war either, and that's got much more publicity.
Yeah.
No one talks about that in the election campaigns that are on. Well, no one talks about that with any real sense of being able to do something constructive.
It's sort of similar. There are these slow-motion disasters that there's too many people invested in benefiting from them that even though they are terrible, their politicians are paralyzed.
I have heard from the research I've been doing on these programs on prisons is that the guards themselves have a lot of psychological trauma being part of going in each day, coming home.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk more about that in the coming weeks, but do you run into any of that with the project that you're part of?
Not really, although, you know, it's known that, I mean, guards are pretty much the kind of people who would end up in prison. If they're the sons and daughters of the working class who found a decent paying job instead of the people who are in prison who are the sons and daughters of the working class that didn't find a decent job, which there are ever less of these days in this age of globalization. When they do studies, they find that, yes, guards have very high rates of alcoholism and wife beating and that kind of stuff.
Bruno, I want to give you the opportunity to share with our listeners anything you would like to at this point about the project that you work with.
You know, one thought I've had about this project and all the other groups that send books to prisoners is that there's no reason why they're so limping along and just scraping together enough money and book keep going and struggling, because what we do is sort of thing it seems like a lot of people could support, which is sort of, you know, literacy and getting programs to help prisoners put their lives together. It seems like, you know, the establishment could actually be doing this. It's kind of crazy that they don't, like that the publishers don't get together, and there's the book industry is incredibly wasteful. I know from working in bookstores, there's zillions of books out there that get returned from bookstores, and they could be packing prisons with good books. And it could be one pretty easy thing that larger society could see to that wouldn't be very expensive or difficult. But it means like dealing with foundations and being organized, and groups like ours have their virtues and their, you know, they're also the fact that they're always struggling. It's fatiguing too.
When you get these books and you send them off, who pays for the postage?
Oh, we do. It's like our main expense is the postage, which probably like almost $2,000 a month.
Mm.
We probably send, we've sent out a couple thousand books a month, maybe more.
Out of this office?
Yeah. You know, we just scrape together donations. Actually, one thing we do is we get a lot of books donated to us that are much better for selling. You know, they're hardbacks and they're really scholarly books or things that prisoners wouldn't probably want. So we turn around and sell those, and that's how we get a lot of the money for postage.
Huh. Where do you sell them?
Well, at Moe's, where I work, or actually Bound Together. I have a sales shelf of books that brings in, you know, $400 or $500 a month. Every year there's an anarchist book fair, and we have a couple of tables full of books, and we make it, I don't know, at least $1,000 out of that.
Mm. That's every...
every March.
Bruno, I want to thank you for being with us. That's Bruno Ruland of the Prison Literature Project, talking about sending books to prisoners around the country, right?
Yeah, all over.
Yeah, and again, you can learn more about the project at www.prisonersliteratureproject.com or email prisonlit@yahoo.com if you want to know more. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you.
These are letters from inmates. This one comes from Craig, and it's actually written on a on the back of a Thanksgiving menu that was, I guess, part of the meal that they had for Thanksgiving 2007. Craig writes, "Happy New Year 2008 and Happy Thanksgiving to all of you at Bound Together Books. Thank you for all the times you were a blessing to me, feeding my insatiable readaholic nature. After 30 years of incarceration, reading has been the best form of self-help I have ever participated in while incarcerated. On many occasions, several of us inmates have had dialogues about books and authors we were reading. Had it not been for your books, we might not have had civil dialogues and made a connection." This one is from Harry, and he's in Corcoran Prison in California. He is writing a delayed thank you to Prison Literature Project. "You have no idea how much the books are appreciated. I don't own a TV or a radio, and I don't read fiction novels, so I've spent the past 6 weeks staring at the walls. The books you sent me are a lifesaver. I would have been happy with just one of Nietzsche's books, but the book you sent me, the portable Nietzsche, contains four full books of his writing and other essays and papers. Another book you sent was from John Stuart Mill's, called On Liberty. I know a little about Mill's from studying the development of logic, but I've never had a chance to read his On Liberty before. Last night, I started your Stephen Hawking's universe. I love science and cosmology. Anyway, I just wanted to say thank you for the great books you sent. They will be enjoyed by all of us here. In parentheses, we always share what we get." Bobby Ray, currently an inmate at Volusia County Branch Jail in Daytona Beach, Florida. "I think reading is the greatest gift available for prisoners, with one exception, freedom. Freedom is the only gift better than reading, and it's going to be a long time before I can obtain my freedom. So I am doing what it is in my power to pursue my reading. Reading is a prisoner's only means of escape, and when my mind is engrossed in a book, I am far away from this place and at peace with the world and myself. I'm writing with hopes that you can send me some books or reading material. Anything you could send will be cherished and greatly appreciated, and it will not only be enjoyed by me, but will be passed along and enjoyed by many inmates for a long time. Thank you for your time and consideration." Cesar says, "Someone once said, literature brings you knowledge. Knowledge brings you wisdom. Wisdom brings you enlightenment of your soul. I'm into literature that relates to knowledge of the whole world around me, like the Dalai Lama, concepts to the meaning of life. I read a book by Bo Lazoff called We're All Doing Time, and it was a great learning experience. I've also read Dante's Inferno. In all reality, whatever you have to read that relates to world history, end of the world events, philosophy, the meaning of life, or Albert Einstein's autobiography, Tolstoy, Kepler, etc. Thanks very much to the Prison Literature Project." And he ends with a quote, "An act of kindness perseveres through the ages. An act of unkindness only lasts a few moments. Thanks for your kindness." And here we have one from Jose Luis. "Projects such as the Prison Literature Project is all an inmate has to stimulate one's mind and keeps the mind from becoming mentally injured for life. Books on my behalf Help me with the proper care, training of mind and body. I can only nurture my mind through great books, and books help me develop my character. And for this simple reason is why I'm requesting books. They help me cope with an ugly confinement. I understand it is my fault for deciding to break society's laws, but when a person is born and raised in a drug/gang-infested, violent and poor barrio, more or less a person becomes a product of such environment. I'm in search of books that can help me understand people's behaviors, moods, ways of thinking, and characters better. Information such as requested might help me understand myself a lot better, as well as my own environment. If you don't mind, can you enclose a National Geographic? Rad writes, thank you for the books. I'm so glad that there are people like you that are so willing to take time to send books to us. It makes it so much easier here to have something to read. I especially like the book on suicide prevention that you sent. It couldn't have come at a better time. I have dealt with thoughts of suicide for many years, and so has my current cellmate. I have also decided that when I get out of prison, I'm planning on starting my own prison literature project in Phoenix, Arizona, to service all prisoners and jails in Arizona. Thank you for all you do. Keep up the good work. Jack, he writes, I saw two beautiful small gray wolves just behind the prison fence outside my cell window, where the deer are usually grazing with their generations of families. Haven't seen the bald eagles much this year. They have to follow the food chain, fish runs mostly. But these three red-tailed hawks and two sparrow hawks enjoy the eagles' absence, as well as the ravens that are the size of chickens. Thank you for the books. We have a letter from Mr. Marshall from Camden, New Jersey, and he thanks the Prison Literature Project for books. And then he goes on to describe life in jail. In a few minutes, the tear will again slowly come to life as 75 men shake off their sleep and resume the interminable process of dying. It happens slowly, one day at a time, as another miserable sunshine will bring another blanket of heat into our private little pockets of hell. That seems to happen quickly, as it had the day before. Here you come to realize that birth means conflict and brings to us immutable experiences. Dying from the moment of birth, to be born and live is to feel the sharp pain of hunger, the shaking chill, the burning fever, the loneliness of love, and the madness of hate if you are not careful. You can remember the fire of passion, the shadow of regret, the brief sunshine and joy, and at last, perhaps the icy touch of my death. This is one hell of an experience. People here for the most part appear dysfunctional, believing in the existence of fairness even though an invisible barrier and security is in place. I have much to say and no one to say it to, so thank you for your time. Here we have a poem by Robert in Draper, Utah State Prison. I won't be home for Christmas, not even for New Year's Eve. I have been a bad boy in the prisons where I'll be. But even here it is Christmas time, we all get into the act. Cards are being shipped home, the man ain't on our back. There's ramen spreads all the time, it's a Christmas feast, that's right. You can hear carols being sung on Christmas Eve night. We think a lot about our families, we wish we were home. Christmas time in the joint reminds us of what we've blown. Finally, I wanted to read this one. My name is Kenneth, I'm currently convicted and unjustly serving an impossible triple life sentence, steeping in such sedated servitude that no regular human being could feasibly flourish while maintaining a modicum of sober sanity, sliver of self-identity, or even the faintest vestige of humanity. Still, I tread onward through the toil, tenaciously trapped in timeless trepidation, accompanied by torrential tides of turmoil and waves of worrisome woe. Of all the places that I have been, the things that I have seen, what you call a nightmare, are what I have seen as dreams, as bad as that may seem. It is only going to get worse. Love or a slug, which one am I going to get first? The serious sentence was cruelly conducted to eternally ensure that I, like my poor predecessors, ceaselessly churn in the chaotic savagery of this carnal concrete circus of cataclysm and cryptic ghostly automation. Ignorance enabled my impetuous oppressors to ruthlessly railroad me, legally lynch me in a public parade of pestilent phoniness that is prevalent in parasitic politics, especially while in pursuit of powerless people, and callously condemned me to the claustrophobic confines of this cramped cage. I have since decided to relentlessly remedy this dismal damnation of doom, depression, and dehumanizing deprivation by delving deeply into the tattered, outdated pages of the sparse books available. Your precious program has previously provided me with much-needed learning material that decisively aided me in furthering the enhancement of my intellectual capacity. I truly appreciate your selfless sacrifice, immense mercy, and timeless touch. Thus far, such aid has inexplicably enabled me to elevate and continuously evolve from this phantomish frailty frequently found in the floundering flock of the faceless forgotten and the fading infirm to a profound platform amid the fortunate few, capable of sustaining a single thought or idea longer than a gnat's lifetime, that is, 24 hours. If possible, I would like more learning materials. My topics of interest are lateral thinking, deductive logic, puzzles, riddles, brain teasers, memory enhancement, ancient philosophy, critical thinking, and a thesaurus. This insidious institution grudgingly allows its captives up to 5 softcover new or used books per delivery as long as they are properly packaged. Thank you for any assistance you can provide. Still, it is dark and hell is hot. To get in touch with the Prison Literature Project, go to prisonlit@yahoo.com or visit the website at www.prisonersliterature.com. And that's our show for today. Thanks for listening to Raising San Radio on KZSU Stanford. And you're invited, as always, to email me at susan@raisingsandradio. Music today was The Police, I'll Be Watching You, and Willie King, Terrorize.